Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Eating Matters is produced by Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station devoted to all things food. Help keep HRN alive by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate. Hi, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. For the past two centuries, milk has been touted as a perfect food, natural, pure, and nutritional. And today, fluid milk drinking is a core part of the American diet, especially among children. But was this always the case? When and why did fluid milk become so ubiquitous? To help us answer these questions in detail, author Melanie Dupuy is joining the show to discuss the religious, political, and sociological factors of the past two centuries that paved the way for fluid milk to become a major American food habit. Later on the show, we will be joined by Liz Vaknin and Shelley Golan, co-founders of Our Name is Farm, this week's featured startup. But before we get into our discussion on milk, my associate producer, Taylor Lanzette, is with me today to go through some of the biggest food policy stories from the past week. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Jenna. How are you?
Good. What's going on?
So 2 weeks ago, we talked about the GMO labeling law that was being pushed through the Senate as an attempt to stop Vermont's GMO law.
Mm-hmm.
And last Thursday, it passed in the Senate and got a primetime spot on the agenda in the House for yesterday afternoon. And so, again, just as a reminder, the Robert Stenenow bill would preempt state GMO labeling laws and give the USDA 2 years to develop rules for how companies can label GMO ingredients, be it on the package, through a symbol, or through QR codes.
Okay.
And so, Jenna, I think the key thing here is it still requires some identification or acknowledgement that GMOs are in the product.
Right, but this bill just gives companies the option to choose how that information is displayed, right? Using three different options?
Correct.
Which that seems, by the way, like it's going to be not streamlined, but whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, again, with the QR codes, it puts it onto the consumer to sort of figure out what it actually
entails. To look up the information.
Yeah.
Right.
But so when it got to the House Rules Committee passed a rule that barred amendments from being added during the considerations,
which essentially prevented it from becoming weaker and like voluntary. Right. Which is incredible because didn't the House's original bill call for voluntary labeling? Only?
Yeah. So last year, the House's bill essentially was trying to push through it to, again, sort of preempt Vermont's that everything would be voluntary.
Right.
But, you know, it's pretty funny because reading what lawmakers were saying and ones who would have preferred having a voluntary bill are now just saying it's great because it's going to preempt Vermont's, as if that's now the main goal.
So politics as usual.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay, so now, then what happens? The House is going to vote on the consolidated bill, and then what?
Yeah, so it's not clear when the official vote from the House will be. It could be today or any day soon, but it's likely to pass, and then, as you know, Obama just needs to sign it into law.
Okay, and we will be keeping you listeners abreast of the situation as it develops on our Twitter feed, so be sure to check it out.
So another news update is last week Congress passed the Global Food Security Act, which reaffirmed the U.S.'s commitment to ending global hunger, poverty, and child malnutrition. And advocates estimate that the legislation will help over 800 chronically malnourished, including 500 million children.
This was refreshing, I thought, looking at this come to fruition, because it seemed to be very bipartisan, which is,
yeah,
you don't see that very often coming out of our Congress. And it's also important because it's part of the administration's Feed the Future program, which launched in 2010 to address global hunger and insecurity, which will continue. This bill essentially ensures that work will continue beyond the Obama administration.
Yes, exactly. Clearly, Obama and Michelle just have a pretty, they've been doing a lot of good food work.
They do. They love their food work, and we love them for it.
Okay. Danone, the French multinational corporation.
Nailed the pronunciation, by the way. Great job.
Based in Paris, just acquired White Wave Food Company for $10.4
billion. That's a lot of money.
Yes. And some of us probably know White Wave because it's the conglomerate that includes Silk, So Delicious, Horizon Organics, and Earthbound Farm Organics.
So this is, this is interesting, not so surprising, because consumers, we have seen, a bigger push for simple natural products, and sales are growing really quickly in these sectors.
Right. And the small companies are going to get acquired, by the larger ones. And we saw this last year when Hormel Food Corp bought Applegate Farms for $775 million.
Mm-hmm.
And also when General Mills bought Annie's, as we all know, Annie's Mac and Cheese for $820 million.
Right. What's also fascinating to me about this is that we're seeing a big dairy company really try to diversify its portfolio to reflect demand, because, as we know, White Wave specializes in plant-based foods.
Right.
And even though milk is still ubiquitous, which we're going to talk about today, consumption of fluid milk has decreased since its height in the 1970s. So an interesting shift in consumer behavior towards these like plant-based milk products.
Totally. Another favorite drink for some. By 2020, your favorite can of beer might include a nutritional label. Six brewers, including the three giants, Anheuser-Busch, Heineken, and MillerCoors have voluntarily agreed to start posting nutritional info on all their containers for sale in the U.S.
This seems great. I'm all about, transparency in our food system, but I feel like I learned all I needed to know with regard to the nutritional content of beer in college.
Really?
When I gained 15 pounds. I felt like that was like information enough for me.
Now is the time to give feedback.
Okay.
Publicly comment.
Comments? All right. Well, I will include that. Yeah.
To the USDA.
They would definitely want to know that, I think.
Yeah. All college-bound students. And last up, we just can't get enough of SNAP. This is really exciting because anti-hunger advocates and lawmakers rallied to support the expansion of SNAP to be used to purchase online food. And yesterday, Thrive Market sort of was leading this charge with these lawmakers, and Thrive has already gained 40,000 signatures in the past 2 weeks, and Thrive Market is an LA-based online grocery store.
And so they are petitioning the USDA to expand the use of benefits for their online for online sales, which is great. So it should be noted they're not the first to do this. Fresh Direct, for instance, has had a pilot in existence in the Bronx that allows SNAP recipients to make purchases with their benefits online. But I think we're definitely in agreement that we're really excited about this gaining traction.
For sure. And Thrive also is going to, because there is a membership fee, and to allow more low-income individuals to participate, the membership fee of somebody who pays for the full cost membership actually subsidizes the membership of somebody who would be potentially using SNAP.
They're great. I want to have them. They're invited to come on
awesome.
The show as a featured startup. And I would love to talk to them more about this because it is really, really exciting. Okay. That wraps it up for our news segment today. Thank you, Taylor. And be sure to tweet or direct message us at EatMattersHRN if you want to include a particular update or if you have thoughts on the ones we discussed today.
Yeah. Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you. Before the break of day, Scott's out of school for
quoting John Janet, but you're off to go and play with Papa anyway. Okay, turning to the topic at hand. Today we are going to be speaking with Melanie Dupuy, author of Nature's Perfect Food, How Milk Became America's Drink. Melanie is the chair of environmental studies and science at Pace University and is also professor emeritus at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Melanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we're really excited to talk about this topic with you today. Taylor, you are...
I'm a big fan.
You're a big fan, a big fan of Melanie's End of Dairy.
Yeah, I read your book 5 years ago, and it then influenced my senior thesis in college.
That's great.
Yeah, love dairy over here.
Yes, so it was Taylor's suggestion to cover this topic, and I'm really excited that we are doing it today. And I have to say, so when I was reading this book, the title itself caused a few raised eyebrows, and it was definitely a conversation starter because people would just look at the book and at first glance would assume that the title, Nature's Perfect Food, was the statement you were trying to make. But one of the things you are very, you clarify very early on is that you're not speaking to whether or not milk is healthy, but you're more interested in how it became such an important part of Americans' diet.
Well, that's the question I was asking in the book, is why did Americans consider milk a perfect food for so very long? Probably there's a number of reasons for that. People were thinking about it as nutritionally perfect, as almost like drinking a liquid multivitamin with protein and fat. And the idea was that this kind of that milk was a complete food, that it had almost all of the nutrition, that because infants could live on milk alone, then the idea was that all mammals could basically live on this substance.
Right. So let's go back and just sort of situate, like, what time period are we talking about? You know, when this idea started to take hold.
As I talk about in the book, I go back to the early 19th century when reformers were concerned about a couple of different things. One was that there was a huge amount of infant mortality in the cities. And, you know, this is way before the theory of germs or germs were discovered. People were starting to realize that there was a relationship between infants drinking milk, or young children drinking milk from these what they called swill dairies. Reform and milk drinking have been going together for various reasons since the beginning of the country.
Yeah. And so one of your main arguments in Nature's Perfect Food is that the rise of our industrial milk shed has a lot to do with religious and political ideologies, which you're beginning to mention, but not just capitalist interest. Can you situate for us why milk is different in this regard to, let's say, corn or commonly grown grains that are often associated with sort of the rise of the capital market?
Milk solved some problems for legislators, right, for politicians. For the rural politician, what they really needed was for farmers to be able to make a living, to be able to maintain livelihoods. You know, as the 19th century progressed, the New York farmers were really getting outcompeted by farmers to the West, and they needed to find an alternative. At the same time, in the cities, particularly New York City, with a burgeoning immigrant population, a growing number of people who were having a hard time being able to afford to feed their children, milk became a sort of solution to, when they were thinking about it as a perfect food or as a complete food, they would also talk about it as a protective food. That is, that even if your diet was poor in other ways, this sort of liquid multivitamin would enable children to grow healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about legislators sitting in Albany trying to figure out how to meet the needs of their constituents. One is saying what we really need is a cheap form of nutrition, and the others are saying, well, what we really need to support our farmers. And that really is basically the same thing that happened nationally with other cheap food policies.
And so why did you focus on New York, and what was it about this region that sort of prompted sort of those legislators and those farmers to find a solution? And was this happening in any other regions around a similar time?
You know, if you want to look at the history of reform in America, you really have to start in the Northeast, and in particular in those areas where people were looking at the rise of urbanization and saying that, you know, seeing the cities as centers of ill repute. Temperance reform, dietary reform, dairy reform, abolition all really pretty much went together. All of those movements have generally tended to be tied together in American reform history.
One of the justifications for the heavy promotion of milk drinking that you write about is that it is a quote natural substance, and it's universal throughout time and space, partly because it is the first food to sustain the human body and contains everything you need in the universe of nutrition, you know, during those early days or months. But it seems that somewhere in our history, cow's milk became conflated with breast milk, right? So I'm wondering, you know, at what point did this idea first start to take root?
Well, first of all, we have to remember also that replacing breast milk with cow's milk was a pretty bad idea. I go into why American middle-class women, particularly in cities, tended to choose cow's milk over breastfeeding. If it were good for calves, it should be good for children as well.
Which it turned.
You know, you see that in advertisements on milk cartons even today, in some milk cartons.
Right.
You know that cows are. You know, cows know how to feed their calves, and they know how to feed your kids too.
Yeah, and the irony, of course, being that as women started feeding, doing more what you call artificial feeding of cow's milk and less breastfeeding, infant mortality rates. There was a drastic increase during that time.
The infant mortality rate was probably, as strong, if not more, with the middle class, because it was middle class women who were feeding, who were buying, and feeding their children cow's milk. You know, working class, poor women couldn't afford to buy milk. They had to breastfeed. You know, it's when middle class people find that they're that there's a health crisis, they have a tendency to notice and get it publicly noticed.
And one of the things you talk about in the beginning of the book is that most people, in fact, are not biologically able to digest fluid milk. Is that correct?
Well, yes. First of all, it's not possible to produce milk all year long except with an industrial milk system,
right?
And part of what I talk about in the book is how that system developed that enabled cities to get a flow of milk all year long, because cows are animals that tend to give birth in the spring, and they tend to then lactate in the spring, and in the winter they tend to not lactate.
So you said there are two subpopulations that were conditioned throughout history to drinking milk. Can you tell us what those were?
The groups that tend to be, they have least number of lactose intolerant individuals, tend to be Northern Europeans and the Maasai in Africa. And these are two different ways of adapting to local agroecologies in those areas. You know, the Maasai are in areas that have very low water in between. You know, with transhumanists, you go from waterhole to waterhole.
They're nomadic.
And the cows basically function as containers of fluid. basically, you know, they're your food, but they're also kind of your water bottle.
Yeah.
At least during the sort of traditional Maasai culture.
This topic is fascinating, but we're going to take a really quick commercial break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about pasteurization and the rise of the, how milk kind of ushered in this era of the industrialized food system. So stay tuned for more.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with Melanie Dupuy about the rise of popularity of milk in America. Melanie, at what point in our history did we decide to pasteurize milk products, and what were the effects of pasteurization on the industry?
So those who do the history of the rise of industrial organization talk about the earliest industrial organizations. They often bring up Borden's. In order to, as
Borden, farmers, the milk company?
Yes.
But Borden, okay, sorry. Yeah.
Right. So, as reformers began to convince people that milk was definitely a problem and needed to be created in a more sanitary way, here's the first part is that, reformers said, bring milk in from the country, our country milk is pure and everything will be fine. But, of course, those folks out there who, think about supply chains nowadays know that the further your supply chain is away from the eater, the more likely there are middlemen in there sort of messing things around.
Mm-hmm.
And that tended to be true for that sort of early country milk system,
mm-hmm.
is that as the milk went down into the city on the trains, a lot of water and other things would get added. And so it really required a system with a lot of inspection, a lot of rules on the farm for how you, sanitation in the barns and so on. So the government brought in those kinds of rules,
When did the first pasteurization?
The large scale. I'm sorry. That's sort of the industrial. Folks like Borden were able to sort of put together the kinds of companies that could sort of follow the milk all the way from the barn into the city and keep it in. And so that kind of organization tended to transform the farm because the farm had to be able to produce milk all year long. It had to be, those tended to be larger scale farms. So there was industrialization going on basically in terms of new technologies, mm-hmm. and so on on the farm, but then there were new technologies to bring milk to the city and then pasteurization to also keep it sanitary. And it was really only the large companies also that could afford to pasteurize.
Right.
At the beginning, it was a fairly expensive process. So,
and didn't Borden start doing that before they legally had to, before it was a regulation?
Yes, they did. And not very long before, people were actually suspicious of it because they thought that pasteurization was actually just taking bad milk and trying to cover it up. And there was a lot of arguments about whether or not pasteurization should be imposed by the government, required, very much like the kinds of food safety arguments that we've been having in the last couple of years about, what kind of food safety regulations should we impose and will they sort of drive smaller farmers out of the business and, require kind of, make our current industrial food system even more industrialized. That's certainly something that, people have been talking about ever since the pasteurization debate.
So pasteurization kind of, in a way, forced industrialization of this product?
Well, I think that you can't really say it's one thing. I think it was pasteurization. I think that it was scaling up. I think it was technology, other technologies. It was transport. It was regulation. It was the And, you know, but it was all of the things that seem so familiar today in terms of when what we think about in terms of the rise of the industrial food system of any other industrial commodity. But it really happened in milk first. And the kind of large-scale sort of industrial processing company necessary to make that sort of system work. But, you know, Bart Borden sort of represents one of the first of those.
How did the way Americans view the farmer change with the rise of fluid milk drinking? And what were some of the repercussions of this perception? Also, I'm wondering if you think it's indicative of how we view farmers in today's society and the role of rural America. I just threw four questions at you. let me know if you want me to break that down.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, reformers thought of this of the country as the natural and the city as the degraded, and thought that if we just bring the country into the city, everything will be fine.
Right.
And then with the, you know, just about the time that people started arguing about whether or not there should be pasteurization, people also started arguing that some dairy farmers were better than others, and that we needed to get the bad dairy farmers out. And those, you know, if you look at the pictures of, and they'd have pictures, these were sort of the early nutritionists, the early food safety experts in the state. Started to, you know, because it's sort of a rising food group of food professionals, and they sort of showed that, you know, they would show this guy milking a cow in a kind of white, you know, quite kind of a, one of those white sort of science,
a lab science-y
gowns with a little white hat, which, you know, believe me, it does not happen even today. But it was sort of to represent, you know, and then they would show these other farmers and sort of show, look at how bad their practices are. Hmm. With the idea that, you know, that there were these bad farmers that we, and usually those farmers tended to be the smaller farmers. So there were, you know, that the idea that we, and that regulations therefore would sort of take the bad farmers out and leave us with the good hmm. actors. So that was, that's sort of been the, you know, even today when you look at the food safety regulations, you hear people say exactly the same thing.
Right. Okay. And the last thing we really want to ask you about is in your book you characterize the organic dairy customer and the rise of NIMBY, which is not in my body. But you say that these customers don't seem to really view themselves as part of a larger political movement towards clean food. What they might just purchase organic dairy, organic milk, but that's it. Can you elaborate on why you think this is and if you think anything has changed?
Well, you know, this book came out quite a while ago.
We're cutting edge, as always.
I'm sorry.
I just made a joke about how we're always on the forefront of, you know, the food literary world.
Yeah, it was one of the early food books. There are lots more now. In fact,
right.
There are many, many more milk books now.
But yours is the best.
you know, at the time, that was during the time, and I had spent a bunch of time sort of looking at the rise of Horizon Milk. And if you look at how Horizon Milk sort of advertises itself, it's really about, you know, sort of mothers taking good care of their children and, you know, feeding them something that's safe. And then that's mm-hmm. been, you know, that's been a way of selling milk and a lot of other foods for a very long time.
Right.
You know, as opposed to, say, you know, if you look at, you know, it's really, I mean, it's one of the things I still collect milk cartons. I have an attic full of milk cartons. It drives my family crazy. But if you look at sort of the different ways in which people have advertised milk, you know, there are those who advertise it in terms of the farmer. You know, this is the farmer. He's mm-hmm. he or she is the steward. there's often sort of children in those pictures. You know, they are, if you look at the Organic Valley.
Organic Valley does that, yeah.
Cartons, right? As opposed to the industrial milk is usually just a glass of milk and saying, this is healthy, and if you drink it,
right.
You know, it's good and white and pure.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Horizon had this great sort of, you know, advertisement on the milk carton, which was like, you know, cows are mothers too. And it was appealing to motherhood and parenthood because they had looked at the data, and the data basically says that that people were buying organic milk, mostly parents for children.
Yeah.
At the time. And now are there a lot more people buying organic for the sake of the environment now? Well, I hope so. But they've always shown, like the marketing has always shown, that there are two groups of people who buy organic, and one is people who care about the environment, and the other one is basically parents buying it for their children or people buying it for their own personal health.
Okay. All right. With that, Melanie, I think we're going to have to end it there. Can you just tell our listeners really quickly where they can go to get a copy of this book, Nature's Perfect Food, and of your new book, Dangerous Digestion?
Well, Nature's Perfect Food was and Dangerous Digestion are both available on Amazon. The first one was published by NYU Press, and the second one published by UC Press. They're both available online on Amazon.
Awesome. Great. All right. Well, thank you
perfect.
So much for joining the show today.
Thank you.
You know what time it is. Okay. It's time for our segment on startups, where we feature an innovative and exciting new food company at the end of each episode. Today, I'm pleased to introduce Liz Vaknin and Shelley Golan, co-founders of Our Name is Farm, a digital media and event production company that works in support of sustainable food growers, producers, and consumers. Liz and Shelley, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi.
I'm really excited you're here. Okay, so tell us about your company. What kind of work do you guys do?
So Our Name is Farm is a digital media and event production company that works exclusively with sustainable farmers, producers, and supporters of sustainable food systems. Our signature product in the digital media side is video,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and we produce marketing video content from like Instagram kind of videos to much longer, more documentary style pieces. And we also produce other digital media content, websites, anything that exists in the digital realm. And then for event production, we do collaborative brand activation, which is where we facilitate and run events that take advantage of multiple brands in partnership together to maximize their exposure and also maximize the benefit to the consumer.
What made you guys decide to get into this digital and events planning space? When did you decide this, and what was the sort of original impetus?
Right. So Our Name is Farm started as a blog about 3 years ago, and we essentially just started talking to farmers and started this video blog just kind of as a hobby to profile our interests and have some sort of body of work that Shelley and I could show off. She was working in production and I was working in fine dining. And it essentially transformed into a full-scale production company when we were approached by the Berkshire Tourism Bureau to start producing videos to boost their agritourism profile. And then mm-hmm. the kind of light switch went off and we were just like, okay, we could maybe do this full time. So we slowly started going into more digital media, and we kind of segmented into doing digital media and event production when we realized you couldn't have one without the other. They kind of really just inform each other.
In today's day and age.
Right. Yeah.
And what is the overall kind of goal and mission of the company?
So Our Name is Farm has a very strong social component,
mm-hmm.
And that is to increase access to good, wholesome food. And that is a part of our business dealings. even as a for-profit company.
Right. So we essentially have a set of skills. We take that set of skills to work with brands that pay us, and then we use that set of skills to also give back to our community. For example, last summer we did a video series for Grow NYC. This year we devoted a lot of our time recording, let's say, cooking classes at the Food and Finance High School, et cetera, et cetera. So we kind of use our same set of skills that we would, you know, set aside for for-profit companies, and then use our extra time to give back to the community.
And work with nonprofits and educational.
Correct. Mostly educational opportunities.
Organizations.
Yes.
What are your backgrounds? Did you guys both come out of the food industry? Liz, I'm going to... You were working in fine dining, so I think that's a yes.
Right, yeah. Yes. Yeah, I went to culinary school. My background before that was in communications, and I started out in fine dining, kind of did my own thing for a while, and then started Our Name Is Farm.
And Shelley?
Yeah, Liz and I met in college. Both of us went to college in Israel, and both of us were there for undergrad. Liz was studying communications, as she said, and I was studying organizational psychology.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which I'm not doing.
Not that. Doing, yeah.
Not doing right that. Right, not doing
you
that
you
right.
will once Our Name Is Farm grows. And
yeah,
and
maybe
gets,
we'll have a clinical psychologist. No, we're not going to do that. My background after college was in fashion marketing, and then I worked for Nickelodeon doing post-production. So I came from the more digital production side of it, and Liz came from the more kind of
event hospitality
side.
And how was the company founded? I think we have a lot of people, a lot of listeners who always, you know, may have some ideas percolating and like want to look to like early inspiration of people who have kind of gone before
them. Speaking about yourself, Jenna.
Maybe speaking about myself. I don't know. Our quote listeners.
Right. So, I mean, the light bulb kind of went off when we started working with the Berkshire Tourism Bureau. But essentially, we kind of just jumped into it. An opportunity kind of landed at our feet. It was a 6-week pop-up that we had kind of been offered to do, and we just jumped right in. There was, like, no business plan. There was, like,
you have
2 weeks to set this up, do
we
it.
We had, at that point, just come to the decision that we were going to incorporate.
Got
we
it.
Like, we finished this series, and we could do this full-time.
Right.
So, yeah, we'll incorporate. We'll do a business plan. We'll, like, come up with our...
We'll get our ducks in a row.
Yeah, figure it out.
Yeah.
And then it was like, nope, we're going to just... run a 6-week cafe out of an art gallery.
We're just going to jump right in, full force,
right.
Very New York.
But we learned a lot. I think that what was great about that experience is that we kind of learned what we were into doing, what we were not into doing, and that helped us like kind of streamline our idea moving forward so that when we finished this project, we had time to sit down, incorporate, and get all of our ducks in a row, so to speak.
What, in your opinion, differentiates your company from other digital and event production companies?
So I think that what makes Our Name Is Farm special is primarily the strength of our network and the breadth of our network. Because we started as a blog and kind of spent almost a full year, almost a year and a half, purely doing this from our own interest to come and record the stories of the farmers in our community, our base was built upon a network of farmers. And a lot of production companies and digital media companies, primarily in the food scene, don't have as strong a focus on that part of the food chain.
So production.
So from the beginning, we had kind of an insight and an in to the food world that many of our peers didn't have. And that, I think, is one of our biggest strengths, is our ability to leverage our network to our benefit, to our network's benefit.
Right, especially now when we do a lot more collaborative brand activation, it's generally really hard to get farmers to work together and kind of have that collaborative aspect. I think it's more and more in the forefront now, but definitely when we started doing this, you know, it was a lot harder, and now we're finding it's a little bit easier, but it's still great to have access to that network of people who trust you and trust to represent your brand, you know, in the best light possible.
What is something happening in the food movement right now that you guys are particularly excited about, or that makes you feel optimistic about the future of food?
Right. So I kind of just touched on that a little bit, actually. We're most excited about the idea of collaborative workspaces. When you talk about the food scene, you have, you know, like the more urban food scene, and then you have the like more like farm, like removed
rural
food scene.
Yeah.
Rural. in the food scene in urban places, I think it's translated more into food halls and stuff like that, which we love because you can, you know, as a consumer, you can go in and not have to choose kind of what you want to eat. You can just get a little bit of everything, and that's super exciting.
What's a food hall that you guys are really supportive of?
I love the Vanderbilt food hall. I think it's really great that Urban Space finally got, like, a brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. I think that they do a really good job of curating their suppliers, and of course, you guys are located at Roberta, so you would totally agree.
Obviously, yeah.
Chelsea Market has grown so much in the number of... it's become more of a food hall than a shopping...
Definitely. Right, right.
But I think it's in terms of, like, modern collaborative spaces, like, mm-hmm. Vanderbilt is a really good representative of that.
Yep.
In the more farming scene, I think that the collaborative aspect is translated into sharing equipment, mm-hmm. you know, creating food hubs so that all the farmers don't have to drive down their stuff, let's say from the Catskills to the city. They could just have one drop-off space that one guy does a run once a week, and it saves money, it saves time, and again, the
streamlines
and the brand exposure. You know, when you have a lot of brands working together, your network is just larger. So I think that all in all, it's good, and we're happy because you can't fix this, like, broken, you know, food system with one person. So the fact that mm-hmm. people are all jumping on board and realizing that it has to be done with a group effort is really monumental, I think.
Awesome. Any advice for those just starting out in the food, in either the food industry and or the food entrepreneurial space? For our listeners.
Don't work in fine dining. No, just kidding.
Personal experience. Yeah, I think that the biggest advice that we could give is sometimes you just have to do it. Mm-hmm. And even as many, like, listicles of that you could read of have your business plan and have mm-hmm. this and, you know, make a lot of research. And that's all very important, but at a certain point...
You gotta hustle.
You just gotta do it. And you don't know until you try. We got partnerships with companies that we didn't dream of getting mm-hmm. because we just sent an email or cold called. And no one told us we could do that, and no one told us we couldn't. And so we did it.
All right. I think that's great. So before we wrap up, you guys have a big event coming up this Friday.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. We're going to be popping up at Union Square Green Market on Friday between 4 and 9 p.m. on the north side of the plaza. It's going to be part of Summer Fridays. Union Square has been around now for 40 years, so Grow NYC is celebrating 40 years at Union Square. Mm-hmm. We're going to have an awesome menu with that we've collaborated on with chefs Tara Glick and Chris Lim, formerly of American Cut Steakhouse, mm-hmm. and they're opening up their new project, Butcher and Baker, very soon, I think, in Brooklyn. So,
cool. So you're working with them to do this pop-up.
Right.
We're sourcing
most of the ingredients from the Union Square Green Market, and there's going to be a bunch of other chefs there from restaurants that source from Union Square Green Market on a daily basis to curate their restaurant menus. And it's super exciting because Our Name is Farm was the only non-restaurant invited to participate. So
awesome.
I think that's a testament to how involved
to your culinary skills.
No,
that also.
More just, you know, how much we love the Green Market and how we've supported it and how I think it's so integral into our company story. I mean, we started at the Green Market. So for us to give back to that community at any chance that we get, you know, we're just really happy to do that.
And that's at Union Square on this Friday the 15th.
Yep.
At what time?
9 p.m.
4 to 9.
We're serving PBLTs. It's a pork butt BLT.
On a buttermilk biscuit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Roasted stone fruit iced tea.
You're free on Friday.
Enough said. I'm free on Friday. I mean, I was already going to go, but I think Taylor is going to come with us.
Awesome.
You're going to come back from Boston.
Yeah, there we go.
Just to go. Okay.
We'll save you a biscuit.
All right, great. Okay, and then I think that's all we've got to... Yes, that is all we have time for today. And we're going to have to wrap it up. I want to thank my guests, Shelley and Liz, so much for coming into the studio today.
Thanks for having
us. More information on their company, go to ournameisfarm.com and be sure to look for their booth at the Green Market this Friday.
Yeah, come by.
Thanks, guys. Okay, thank you to all of our guests today and to our sponsors for your generous support. Our show is produced with help from Taylor Lanzette, who also joined me in the studio today, and the show music is by Tim Archer. Thank you to our engineers David Tedeschor and Pierre Benami. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. Like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook, and be sure to find us on Twitter at eMattersHRN. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.